begin, my understanding is, I want to be sure everybody's on the same page here, that an additional 10 minutes?
Five minutes.
Additional 5 minutes per side for oral argument has been allotted. So the appellant has 20 minutes to argue, and you can use your time as you so see fit, you can say for rebuttal. Now, for the appellees, you also have 20, you understand you have 20 minutes collectively. So you will have to allocate the 20 minutes amongst yourselves. I'm not going to get involved in that. You just decide that you'll have to stick to the 20 minutes total. Everybody clear? Okay, with that understanding, counsel, for the appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. Earl Rhodes from Grand Junction, Colorado, bar number 6723. Your Honors, there are two main legal issues presented by this case. The first legal issue is whether the title insurance company had a duty to disclose the document not in the chain of title, which materially affected the transaction. The second legal issue presented by this appeal is whether the trial court committed a reversible error in weighing the credibility of the owner of real property when he testified as to the value of that property on a motion for summary judgment. There are three key facts in this case. Number one, as to the Marceau home, it was discovered that there were high levels of gamma radiation in the basement of the house. And gamma radiation is a cause of concern as to human health. Number two, that in the real estate records of the Mesa County Clerk and Recorder, there was a notice of remediation indicating that at a prior time, mill tailings had been removed from the Marceau house, but also indicated that not all the mill tailings had been removed. And number three, the government regulations prohibited the issuance of a building permit in areas of the house where the high radiation readings existed. It is the plaintiff's contention that the trial court's order of dismissal of the title insurance company should be reversed.
Can I ask you about the third fact that you just enunciated? The government regulation, I'm going to paraphrase, prohibits building where there's been radiation detected. Is that what you said?
Yes.
What government regulation prevents that?
There's a reference in the record at page 258 to a notice which the Marceaus received from the inspector from the State Mitigation Office, which contains the reference to the government regulation. It would be a restriction by the City of Grand Junction as to the issuance of a building permit in that portion of the Marceau house where the high levels of radiation existed.
Excuse me, counsel, I have page 258 of the record up in front of me, and I've looked at 40 CFR part 192. I don't see any building restrictions in that CFR part or in the notice. What are you referring to?
Well, maybe I should look at that, but there's a reference in the notice that there may be a building, there may be restrictions as to a building permit.
It does not say that.
It says there are recommendations, but it doesn't say it's prohibited in any way. And but are you saying there's also a Grand Junction building code provision?
No, I'm referencing the notice, which the information notice, which the inspector from the state office gave.
So that's the entire record that there might be a restriction.
Yes.
Is that one page? Is that one page report of gamma radiation?
So I have a couple of questions for you with regard to the insurance coverage piece of the claim.
Yes.
All right. So your entire opening brief, the argument is that the insurance company did not give the Marceaus disclosure. Two questions about that. Where in the insurance contract is there a duty of disclosure? And second is, how could they have given disclosure of this document that didn't exist at the time, until 2 years later after the purchase?
The duty of disclosure is to the notice of remediation, which was a 1977 document.
Okay, where in the insurance contract is there a duty to disclose?
The contract provides that the title insurance company has a duty to disclose items which affect marketable title.
And where in the insurance contract is that? What first of all, what page of the record are you on? And where in the insurance contract does it say that?
Well, the trial court recites the terms of the insurance contract and states that the contract provision requires the title insurance company to disclose marketable title.
I'm asking you because I've read the policy. I don't see anything where it says that there's a duty to disclose. Can you please point me where in the insurance policy it talks about duty to disclose? There's a duty to pay in certain instances if there's a claim or there's a problem with title, but I don't see anything in the insurance policy that indicates that there's a duty to disclose.
Well, I guess I would refer to the title insurance company brief, which recites the same things that I have recited.
Sorry, counsel, I'm really asking you for policy coverage language. I didn't see any in there.
Well, it is my understanding that the purpose of a title insurance policy is to provide information to the insured as to those things as to which the title insurance company would be liable for.
I understand, but if you're going to make a legal claim, you need to do it based on the language of the insurance policy. Are you saying that you can't point me to anything that creates a duty to disclose?
The reference is what's contained in our brief and what I've told you, which is the duty in regard to encumbrances and the duty as to marketability of title.
You may proceed, counsel.
Thank you. The assertion of the plaintiff is that the trial court's reliance on both the Edwards case and the Arapaho title case is misplaced. In the Edwards case, the title policy expressly excluded information as to taxes. In the Arapaho title case, the contract likewise did not require disclosure of government code violations. The plaintiffs relied upon the federal farm mortgage case, which held that marketability means the title that is reasonably free from such doubts as will affect the market value of the estate, and one in which a reasonably prudent person with knowledge of all the facts and their legal bearing would be willing to accept. And here, as in this case, had the buyers known about the notice of remediation, which implicated health concerns, needs for repair, and stigma damages, they would not have bought the property. Furthermore, Colorado law provides that the restrictions on the Marshall property were an encumbrance, which needed to be disclosed. And this is supported by Feet versus Donahue, where the court found that the zoning violation constituted an encumbrance, not only on the title, but on the real estate itself. This is also supported by Campbell versus Summit Plaza, which affirms that restrictions on the property itself is an encumbrance. It's also supported by Loveland Essential Group, where the failure to disclose a lease on the property constitutes a burden on the real estate itself.
So excuse me, counsel, what about the notice of completion of remedial action constitutes an encumbrance?
Here, that notice implicates this issue of whether the Marshalls had a right of free enjoyment and quiet enjoyment of their property.
Right. The notice of remedial action says that it's been completed. Remedial action had been completed. What about that creates an encumbrance?
The remedial action had been completed, but there's also a statement that not all of the mill tailings had been removed, and thus there were some left.
I'm not seeing that.
But Mr. Rhodes, a notice of remedial action says that the amount of radiation had been reduced, but it said it also had been reduced to acceptable levels. So if the Marshalls had seen that notice before they purchased the house, isn't it more likely than not that they would have said, well, there was a problem before, but it was taken care of?
Well, the Marshalls testified they would have had nothing to do with this house if they had had any knowledge of gamma radiation. So that's their testimony. The second assertion advanced by the Marsos is that the owners provided testimony as to no value of the property.
So before you go on, because that involves the broker, the claim against the brokers, I compartmentalize your case. You started by saying that we're here because the title company failed to disclose. The title policy, as Judge Terry pointed out, does insure against encumbrances. It does insure against encumbrances on the title. But you're not arguing to us a breach of the contract by failure to pay a claim for encumbrance. You're only arguing failure of the duty to disclose. Is that right? On appeal now?
Well, demand was made on the title insurance company for money, and that demand was denied.
So are you arguing on appeal that that is also an error by the trial court in deciding that there was no breach of contract? Because it really doesn't appear from your argument that that's what you're arguing.
No, the argument is that the title insurance company was required to inform the Marsos. The second issue raised is whether the trial court dismissed the plaintiff's case on a motion for summary judgment as based upon the plaintiff's testimony as their own value of the property. This court is well aware that in Kaiser Foundation Health versus Sharp, a trial court is not to weigh the evidence on a motion for summary judgment, but rather all inferences in favor of the non-moving party are being made. And further, in the case of Berglund Cherney, 568 Pacific 2nd 478, Colorado follows the general rule that owners can testify as to the value of their own property. And this is a proposition that has been accepted in Colorado and has been affirmed by, in the case of City of Steamboat Springs versus Johnson. And the owner's testimony that this property had stigma attached to it in their perception because of the presence of high levels of gamma radiation is the type of testimony that is relevant under the factors appropriate under Colorado law. And the trial court should have deemed this testimony admissible and should not have gone to weigh the testimony, and therefore the trial court's decision was in error.
But there was no quantification, if I understand the record, there was no quantification by the plaintiffs of the amount of damages.
And they said the property was worthless.
Zero.
Yeah.
Mr. Rhodes, one of the other arguments that the realtor and the realty company make was that there was no evidence presented of the difference in value between the value as it would have been without the radiation and the value that the Marsos testified to, which is that it was zero. And I didn't see any response to that argument in your reply brief. Was there any evidence of what the value of the Marsos home would have been without radiation?
The testimony in the record is the value of the property that the Marsos purchased it for, and the Marsos testimony that given the conditions of the house with the presence of levels of gamma radiation, the property was worthless. So that's the before and after.
So there was evidence of what the amount that they paid for the house?
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. I reserve the balance of my time.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Counsel.
Hey, please support Jessica Yates representing Fidelity National Title Insurance Company. And I plan to use no more than 10 minutes of the time allotted to appellees. First, Your Honors, I'd like to try to clear up some of the confusion around what is in the policy that would require Fidelity to disclose anything. And pursuant to the questions that have been asked, there is nothing in the policy itself. Now, Fidelity has acknowledged that there are state regulations governing the title commitment process. And that is the process by which Fidelity promises to issue a title policy in the form reflected in the commitment, because the title policy isn't issued until after closing. So the commitment allows the prospective purchaser and their lender to be able to rely on the title commitment. And there are things disclosed in that title commitment, but it's the same that you see in the policy. It's not a broader disclosure process. And in fact, in the statute that's 1011-106 cited in our brief, that defines, along with the regulation that's cited in our brief, the scope of that title commitment. And it makes it clear that an insurance company does not need to disclose things that don't impair title and aren't encumbrances on the property.
1011-106 provides that a title commitment must contain certain things. More or less, that's what it said?
Yes, generally.
Does 1011-106 create a private right of action to an insured who doesn't get that kind of a title commitment?
Your Honor, there is no private right of action that we've located in that statute.
Was there any claim in this case that it was a violation of 1011-106?
No, Your Honor.
Why are we talking about this? With all due respect.
Absolutely. And Your Honor, the reason that we just pointed it out is because the claim was actually made on the policy. And the plaintiff never did disclose the commitment. The commitment wasn't identified in the pleading, the complaint. And Fidelity, I think just being a good insurance company, tried to broadly construe the claim as one for coverage, when in fact they seem to be disclaiming that relief.
Okay. So what was the basis on which coverage was denied, or the claim was denied?
Sure, Your Honor, and that was because there was no impairment of title. There was no unmarketability of title provided through this notice of completion, nor was the violation of an ordinance or code clause in Insured Clause 5 triggered. As you've seen from the notice of completion itself, the 1977 notice does not indicate in any way that there is a third party asserting any kind of enforcement action, any kind of right of possession or right of entry, a right to lien the property. Those are the kinds of things that can trigger an encumbrance, as the Feet case discusses. When you have a zoning violation that gives the city the right to enter your property, to build a structure on the property, or to withdraw the certificate of occupancy. But the 1977 notice of completion did none of those things.
Let me stop you there. The policy covers, and I'm going to just paraphrase paragraph 5, it covers for violations of governmental regulations relating to environmental protection. Does this notice indicate, or does that gamma ray report indicate, a violation of a government regulation relating to environmental protection?
Your Honor, I'll direct you to the section that comes after environmental protection. It says, if a notice is recorded in the public record setting forth the violation or intent to enforce.
All right, so the gamma ray report doesn't fit.
Your Honor, that is our position.
The gamma ray report wasn't in existence at the time.
Right.
That's right, Your Honor. That came back 2 years after the actual consummation of the transaction. So it's that the only thing that existed in the public records at the time was that 1977 notice of remediation. And that on its face indicated not only that the state deemed the work complete, but it said that it effectively had accomplished its objective. It shall be prima facie evidence of completion and acceptance of said remedial work. In other words, from the state's perspective, it says we're out of here. We're done. We think we've done everything we need to do. And it wasn't part of what the Marceaux's put into the record in opposing summary judgment at the time, but it became clear later when there was additional summary judgment briefing between the other defendants. There is no zero level for radiation in the state. There's always a background level. So there would never have been anything in this notice of completion back in 1977 or today saying, oh, there's zero gamma. We don't have to worry. Zero is not actually the standard. And in fact, at the time that this was done, and even today, these kinds of remedial activities are completely voluntary. That was attached to some of the summary judgment briefing between the Marceaux's and the realtor defendants. It's a completely voluntary remediation.
Prior to 1977, there might have been a violation of a governmental regulation pertaining to environmental protection, but you say once this was done, this does not indicate that it's a continuing violation.
Assuming that there could have been a violation, that this notice of completion indicated that had terminated.
Isn't that an issue of fact? And isn't it the case that the trial court made no findings or resolution of that issue of fact? Or can he resolve an issue of fact, given that this is a summary judgment?
Well, I think the answer is no, Your Honor, and for a couple of reasons. One is the Marceaux didn't oppose summary judgment on this basis. They didn't ask for any additional time for discovery. They didn't introduce any factual basis about whether there was any violation of state or federal law that existed in the property at that time. And they could have, under 56F, said, wait a minute, we need some more time for discovery. They didn't do that. So I think that the trial court had no basis to go to those types of facts and look for those kinds of arguments.
Ms. Yates, I'd like to ask you a hypothetical question. If in 1977 there had been, instead of a notice of remediation, a notice of non-remediation saying that there was a concern about the level of gamma rays and it may violate either state or federal law, would Fidelity have had an obligation to disclose that?
Possibly, Your Honor. I mean, obviously, it's difficult with a hypothetical, but I think what Fidelity would be looking for is whether there had been, and I think the words in the coverage is, a violation, an actual stated violation, or a statement of intent to enforce. And the reason that this is important from a title insurance perspective is that when you have a violation or environmental intent to enforce action, usually in most jurisdictions, an agency can go in, enter the property, and that's you're giving a third party a possessory right to your property, a right to enter the property, remediate it, lien the property if the owner doesn't pay for the cost of remediation. So that's an interest in the property that is spectered by the fact that you might have an existing violation. And that's what the fee case really stood for in terms of the zoning violation in that case. If it's just hypothetical, I don't know if there would be a duty to disclose. I imagine a title insurer probably would disclose it if they're not sure, if they're not sure from the face of the document whether the there is an existing violation. Well, I do want to spend a moment on the fee case because opponents do rely on that. And that really, they indicated that it stood for the broader proposition of any kind of building violation ends up being an encumbrance under the law. And it really didn't stand for that. Instead, it was a zoning violation, not a building code violation. And the zoning violation gave the city the right to revoke the certificate of occupancy, which they in fact did. And that interfered with the owner's ability to convey the property, as well as the right to enter the property. We simply don't have those facts that arise from the notice of completion in this case. The fee case also indicated that, well, we've got to do major structural alterations here. But that's not actually what the case turned on. It didn't ask for damages evaluation of major versus minor. Instead, the case really looks to the fact that the owner had lost the ability to convey the property because they couldn't even list it for sale. So those are significant property rights that were evidenced by the fact that there was an existing zoning violation.
Is there anything in the record here that suggests that this provision in CFR limits the ability to build or remodel or do something with this property akin to a zoning violation?
And Your Honor, I did not find anything, certainly in the summary judgment briefing, there was nothing presented as a factual basis from the Marceaux at that time. I do think there is the possibility that the city could ask to inspect the property, that kind of thing, based on the arguments that they made in opposing summary judgment to the realtor defendants. But they never showed that they had applied for a building permit and one was denied. And it is quite speculative to decide whether there could be building in that area and on what conditions. Your Honor, I did promise my co-defendants the balance of the time.
Thank you,
Counsel. Thank you.
May it please the Court, my name is Curtis Shortridge. Our registration number is 9959, and I represent the defendant, Ellie Delbeck, in this case. Ms. Delbeck was a real estate broker. She was the buyer's agent in this transaction that is before the court. The issue that we have been dealing with here is what I want to focus on at this point, which is damages, since that is what the trial court focused on. I want to point out that there is no expert testimony in the record from plaintiffs to establish their damages in this case. I think that is a very important issue here.
Is expert testimony necessary, counsel?
I think expert testimony is necessary here.
To avoid summary judgment?
I think it is, in order to avoid summary judgment on the second issue that we were going to talk about today, which is the measure of damages. The argument that Mr. Rhodes just made was, to my understanding, made for the first time here today, which is that the Marceaux satisfied the second element of the measure of damages by virtue of their having purchased the property for a certain purchase price.
Well, counsel, excuse me, I'd like to go back to what you were just saying.
Sure.
What authority do you have that damages have to be established on a summary judgment level by expert testimony as opposed to an owner's own testimony?
And I think that what I was saying is I think that goes to the second element of the measure of damages, which is essentially the difference between the value of the property with the injury and the value of the property without the injury.
I understand. What authority do you have that expert testimony is required to establish that?
I think that arises from the facts in this case.
No, I'm asking you for a case or a statute or a treatise, something.
There isn't a case, there isn't a treatise that says that expert testimony is required. I think that under the facts here, expert testimony would be required because when the Marceaux purchased the property, it had the injury. And so in order to make a determination of what would be the value of the property without the injury, you were necessarily going to have to go into the theoretical value of the property without the injury that exists. There's no questions that whatever radiation exists in this property existed on the date that the property was purchased and may well exist today.
Well, that's a surprising proposition that expert testimony is required, since there's no case law on that. In fact, there's plenty of case law that says an owner is always competent to testify to the value of his or her own property. So I'd like to direct you to that law. And I know that the trial court went off on another aspect of that law about what weight should be given to the testimony. So tell me why we should change the law to say that an owner cannot testify to the value of his or her own property. And that would be a change in the law.
Your Honor, I don't think that is a change in the law, and that is not what I'm arguing. What I'm saying to you today is, in order to establish the damages in this case, the plaintiffs can provide an opinion. But as the trial court pointed out, and as the case law in Colorado establishes, the owner's opinion must be supported by some rational basis.
Mm-hmm. Called owning the property. That's a rational basis.
I don't agree with that, Your Honor. I think that the cases that we cited to the court establish that something more is required. What those cases specifically say is what the trial court pointed out, that while it is generally true that a landowner can give an opinion about the value of the property, that must be based upon proper considerations. The court cited the Plummer case. We cited some other cases about that. But what those cases say is, yes, an owner generally is entitled to provide an opinion, but that opinion must be based upon proper considerations. And what those cases really go into is there has to be some basis for the opinion other than just the owner saying, this is what I feel.
So Mrs. Marceaux said, I'm paraphrasing,
yes.
Mrs. Marceaux says the opinions were zero. The reason were zero is because it appears to be contaminated by radiation. But I think what you're arguing is that what they haven't shown is the diminution in value because they can't show the starting point as being something other than what they paid for.
Correct.
Some expert has to come in and say, at the day they bought it, given the fact that there was radiation on the property, it really wasn't worth what they paid for it. It was worth what they paid for minus X or something to that effect.
That is correct. And Judge Terry, that is what I was referring to in terms of an expert opinion. It's because of the facts in this case. Because the property was allegedly contaminated at the time of its purchase, I don't know how an owner would be able to provide an opinion about the value of the property without the injury, since the injury existed at the time the property was purchased and supposedly still today. That was my point.
With all due respect, the owner could say, I thought it was worth X and that's why I paid X on the date I purchased the property. Why isn't that competent? The cases that you've cited about improper considerations, the one case, the Plummer case, it wasn't even the owner testifying about the property. It was a husband testifying about the value of wife's separate property. That is an improper consideration. But I don't see anything that gets rid of the old law on this that says that an owner can always testify to the value of his or her own property. I don't see anything that says that a trial court is required to exclude testimony of an owner on the basis that there's some consideration that the court doesn't think is appropriate. That goes to weight, not to admissibility, doesn't it?
I don't agree, Your Honor. I think that what the case is, and the Plummer case indeed is a case that involves someone who wasn't presently the owner. The other cases we cited, State Department of Highways versus Pig, the Denver Urban Renewal case, the Board of County Commissioners case, all go to the point that the owner is entitled to provide an opinion, but only if there is some rational basis to support that opinion. It can't just be their feeling about the property. And I have promised to provide additional time to Mr. Davlin to argue, and we've only got 3:54 left. I don't want to leave him with no time.
Well, let me, I think it's the same argument, but let me just clarify. It seems to me what you're saying is, in a normal fraud case, there has to be testimony. What was the property worth? Mm-hmm. Had the undisclosed fact been disclosed? That's the element that you're saying has to be testified to by an expert, correct?
Here, and only because of the facts here.
But here, Mrs. Marceau said, had the non-disclosure been made, we wouldn't have bought this property, period. And now that it's been disclosed, I think it's worth zero. So it isn't a question of what's the difference between what they paid for it and what would the value have been had it been disclosed. It's what they paid for it versus what it's worth now at the time they now know about the disclosure. Isn't a different measure of damage? Because we're not talking about a straight fraud case. We're talking about non-disclosure of a fact that reduces the property because it's like stigma damages.
Well, and actually that stigma damages part is not anything that was ever testified to. And that's the problem also that the trial court pointed out is neither of the Marceaus actually testified. The value of the property without the injury is X. They said, we wouldn't have bought the property if we'd have known about this. The value of the property, the price they paid for the property is also in the record. But that's all there is. There isn't the kind of testimony that I think is necessary in order to make that connection to satisfy the other leg of that requirement.
But I know we're going over what you anticipated your time with, but why wouldn't it be the case that the amount that the Marceaus paid for their house would be an indication of the value of the home, or at least what they thought the value of the home was at the time they bought it?
I think there's two issues with that. First of all, it is that what they paid for the property may or may not be a reasonable representation of its actual value. But the bigger problem is what they paid for it, there is no evidence that describes that what they paid for it is an accurate measurement of its value without the injury. That's what's missing here, is that leg of the requirement.
Doesn't it follow that it is because they didn't know of the radiation at the time they purchased the house?
And I understand that's the argument being made, but the problem is that the radiation did exist at that time. In other words, whether or not their belief that it didn't exist establishes a value, I don't think it's sufficient in order to provide the kind of certainty and not be speculative that is required generally for damages.
But those are trial issues, not summary judgment issues, counsel. But I'll let you relinquish the rest of your time to your co-counsel.
Why don't you, if the clerk could set the clock at about 3 minutes, just to be fair to counsel, since we ask so many questions, if that's okay.
May it please the court, Sean Davlin, bar number 39520, Durango, Colorado. Your Honor, I just want to focus a couple things following up on your questions to Mr. Shortridge. I agree. I think that this issue on appeal is really about the sufficiency of the evidence. It's not about the credibility. And if we focus on the diminution in value, the jury instruction as it reads, both prongs talk about market value. And this case is about market value. It's not this subjective value to me. I wouldn't purchase it in hindsight knowing. That's not market value. Market value is what a willing buyer and a willing seller would enter into a contract.
But the owner is permitted to testify as to what they believe the market value of the property is.
They are, Your Honor, and it's a presumption. But, it's a rebuttable presumption, and it has to be based upon proper considerations. And the Plummer Court has said that the considerations, it must be shown that the owner had the means to form an intelligent opinion, and that it derived from adequate knowledge of the nature, kind, and value of the property. And then you go on to, you know, these property considerations would be comparable properties. Grand Junction has numerous houses. You know, they spent millions of dollars, the federal government in the 60s and 70s remediating. So a proper consideration would be what these other properties that have been remediated are selling for.
This sounds like impeachment at trial, counsel, not something that you go into on summary judgment.
Well, it's a sufficiency of the evidence argument. The trial court, as a gatekeeper, can say, you know, on a summary judgment standard, that the party opposing summary judgment must offer sufficient evidence to demonstrate a reasonable jury can return a verdict. And at that point, the trial, acting as a gatekeeper, says, no, you know, Mr. Marceau testified that he didn't know what the current value of the property is at the present time. So he can't offer any testimony on that second prong. And then as to Mrs. Marceau, you know, she's basically saying that the property could have value to someone else. It's just not valuable to me.
So in other words, in any case like this where you don't have an expert witness, people can't get past summary judgment.
No, I disagree. I think that if she would have used comparable sales, if she would have used market value, if she would have said, yeah, this property, you know, is a half-acre parcel in Grand Junction City proper. You know,
so she wouldn't have any basis to do that. But you're saying that an owner can never get past summary judgment in a case like this.
No, I'm not, Your Honor. I'm just saying it's almost like it's analogous to a Shrek challenge at this point. No, it's a Daubert challenge. She doesn't have a basis. There's no foundation for her opinion that it's worthless, other than what the federal courts have said is basically a value to me standard, and the value to me isn't market value. So in both prongs of the diminution require market value. The alternative, the jury instructions also say that a homeowner could put up a cost of restoration or a cost of repair or remediation as a measure of damages. They did endorse an expert who was an engineering expert, but he could not determine what the cost of remediation would be. So they've had ample, you know, that's in their expert disclosure. So I mean, they could have done it via expert, they could have done it if they had a proper basis, and they had neither, therefore requesting that the trial court be affirmed.
Thank you, Counselor. The case will stand submitted, counsel.
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. 7 more minutes, excuse me.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have no rebuttal. Thank you very much.
Oh, okay. I won't repeat what I just said. Counselor, excuse this opinion issue.